I'm Chris Youngs, and I'm a monster. And I'm listening to The Tome.
I'm Scott Rouse, and I'm a monster too. And you're listening to The Tome.
This show is a member of Goblin, the gaming broadcast network, gbncom.com.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 49. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interviews podcast, and I am your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we will be beating some 4E info out of Scott Rouse and Chris Youngs. Welcome again to episode 49 of The Tome. Scott Rouse and Chris Youngs from D&D Experience. First of all, I want to say thanks to Jeffrey D. Wynn for part two of his D&D Experience interviews and reports. He's got some fabulous things for you, and I really look forward to getting them out there to you. If you like what you hear about 4th edition from these interviews and from the discussions that we've been having lately, don't forget to hop over to The Tome's Amazon store and pre-order those books. It helps the show make a little bit of money, so hopefully someday I can pay the bills with it. And yes, I know in the last episode when Chris Engler and I were discussing 4th edition monsters, I sort of massively brain farted on Orcus. I'm sorry, I have been playing the game long enough to know better, and let's leave it at that. Also, there's some more 4th edition chatter coming up, plus some reviews of some of the last 3rd edition stuff that's out there, as well as a few edition proof items and more interviews. So stay tuned for those kinds of things, and I hope you enjoy them. Well, without any further ado, let's go ahead and get right into the interview that with Jeffrey D. Wynn, talking to Scott Rouse and Chris Youngs.
All right, so I'm talking to the brand team and the D&D Insider team. Right, I'm talking to Chris Youngs, who's on the D&D Insider team. I'm talking to Scott Rouse, who's on the brand team. What does the brand team do?
So myself and my team, we're responsible for taking the great ideas that R&D has for products and actually working with R&D and the rest of the company to bring the products to the consumer. So take the ideas and make them a reality.
Is that marketing?
It's a combination of product development and marketing.
Okay, what's products?
So that would be how much is it, working with our production team, how much is it going to cost? How many units are we going to make? Working with the sales team to figure that out. When's it going to come out? Looking at the costs, all the development costs that go into the book, the costs of goods, paper costs, printing costs, and figuring out.
You're trying to make a product that's not only fun and entertaining, but also is affordable and comes in a format that people can pick up.
Exactly. Something that trying to make sure that we make money on it, but yet deliver the best quality product that we can. So,
okay,
at an affordable price.
Do you coincide with the D&D Insider on that as well, on pricing and packaging?
Very much. With the advent of D&D Insider, we now also manage the development of that. There's a whole other team that works in conjunction with R&D, the Digital Games Group, that they're doing things like making the applications, the 3D art, the back-end infrastructure, the servers, all that. And so we manage that side of the business as well.
Let me move over to Chris Youngs. You're on the D&D Insider team.
That's right.
Exactly like a Mind Flayer should.
Now, Wizards tried this before, having like software to go with their games. I'm thinking specifically of the e-tools that shipped with the 3.0.
Right.
Why did that not work, and why is this going to work?
Well, I didn't work on the e-tools. I was around during 3rd edition when it launched. I joined Wizards in 98, actually. So I remember only peripherally sort of what happened with e-tools, but I know that it was our sort of first foray into software like that as a company. And I can't really speculate about what went wrong. you know, if you can call it wrong. I mean, it was like I said, it's our first experience, really. So this is going to go right because we've devoted the resources we need to make it work. We have a clear vision. We have a clear directive. We have a great product that we're supporting in fourth edition, which frankly is probably the single most important thing. We've got just this amazing game. And we're working really closely as a company. Within the company, we're all the departments involved are working very closely together with a common goal in mind, which is to make this product just phenomenally good.
All right, so D&D Insider exists to support Dungeons & Dragons 4.0. As time goes by and Wizards develops more products like maybe a new D20 Modern or a Star Wars game, will D&D Insider expand, or will there be parallel online components maybe that might tie in with the D&D Insider? Do you even know at this point?
At this point, we're really just focused on the launch for Dungeons & Dragons. Certainly, if there was interest and if our excellent brand team and sales team thought that there was a market for it, we would certainly look into it. But right now, we're really just focused on Dungeons & Dragons. I mean, to be honest, the whole company is... I mean, just in the last few months, there have been, like, just... We're like, this is our priority as a company right now. We really need to get Insider to the front of the line, right?
And so you've even taken people off of Magic.
People have been coming off of all sorts of different brands and working on this thing. We are going to get it done. I mean, whatever the resources it needs, it's getting.
That's pretty cool. How are you marketing to people outside of the D&D community? The web page has had blogs, and there's been advertisements in Dragon Magazine and in, you know, all sorts of geeky magazines. How are you pulling in, like, new people from outside of this?
It's a good question, and it's something that we have to think about all the time, what we call filling the bucket. Imagine there's a bucket of full of players. There's a hole in that bucket, and some keep draining out, so we have to keep filling them in from the top. So we think a lot about what we call acquisition marketing. How do we acquire the next generation of D&D players? And so those efforts are going to really kick in June, and where we might advertise would be sort of outside of our core audience of players to people that like to play games. So maybe we advertise in a computer gaming magazine like PC Gamer or a console gaming magazine like Xbox Magazine or something like that. And still, people that are gamers, they may have even heard of Dungeons & Dragons, but they don't necessarily know what it's all about. And the two places that will probably three places will drive them would be check out D&D Insider, look at some of the free previews, we'll have tutorials, learn to play videos, things that will teach those people what D&D is. And then we have products that we can direct them to. One would be the miniature starter game, which it's all new this year for 4th edition. It has, the 2.0. It's the 2.0 rules. It has fixed minis in it. You're always going to get the same minis in the box, so we can really write the rules more to speak to those. The starter set. The starter has the five same minis in it, so it's not randomized. So we can write the rules to those minis, those particular warbands. In years past, the starters have been randomized with only two of the same minis, two fixed minis in it. The other thing that we would drive them to is our new role-playing game starter game, which will teach you how to play the RPG. So everything the DM and his or her players need to run a game. There's pre-generated characters, quick start rules, monsters, tiles for creating the dungeon, and a couple scenarios. So, and dice, play out of the box. So that's where...
Are they going to be good dice, or are they going to be like cheap dice that like crumble when you paint the numbers on them?
Yeah, no more crayons to write the numbers on the dice.
Those dice that eventually get round after you've rolled them enough times.
Yeah. Or they cut your finger. They're brand new.
Caltrops.
You were talking about free previews of the D&D Insider. Are we going to see, are we going to see even before the subscription service goes out, are we going to see previews of the online applications, like the character builder or things?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to have a 10-day free trial for D&D Insider for folks who want to check it out. They'll be able to look at basically everything we have to offer. And then we're hoping to also have demos for everything as well online, just sort of live permanently online. We're also going to be offering a free month of our 4th edition Dragon and Dungeon when the new game comes out. So people can get an idea of the actual content.
Of the core books.
No, it's just going to... So right now, the Dragon and Dungeon content that's up on the website is 3.5 content, and it's free. But it really isn't representative of the type of content that we're going to be putting up going forward with 4th edition, because when we transitioned the magazines to our digital model, we knew that 4th edition was coming, right? I mean, and to be honest, there's a lot of 3rd edition content out there. We felt that the best use of Dragon and Dungeon during this transition was, number one, first and foremost, to keep people playing. And we've done that with adventures that we've been putting out for free, 3rd edition 3.5 adventures. And the number two thing was to prepare people for 4th edition, to start getting them used to the concepts and the ideas and the design precepts that really embody 4th edition, and get them to start thinking about the transition, get them to start thinking about wrapping up their 3rd edition campaigns and starting to plan for their first 4th edition games. Well, that's not what we're going to be doing going forward to 4th edition, clearly, because it'll be out, right? So we're going to be returning to more of a traditional approach to Dragon and Dungeon. We're going to be having lots of great crunchy articles.
Not that traditional.
Content. Remember, this is the new digital future. We've got a lot of great things that we can do with the technology that we will be showing people more of as we get closer to launch that you just can't do with print. So...
I'm sure there's lots of different things you can do online, but I just say I really like print magazines. I like being able to pick them up, flip them over, touch them, take them with me to the bathroom, whatever. And, reading it, reading something on a screen and reading something off of a magazine in your hands, you can flip. It's really different experience.
It is a different experience, and we understand that, and it's just an unfortunate realism that the magazine industry, the traditional magazine publishing industry, is just not a healthy place. I mean, it's really an industry that's sort of falling to the wayside right now, and I think we're really seeing it's going to be something that's...
It's going to take a long time, I think.
Right.
You know, I personally, I'm like you, I like to read a book. I don't particularly like reading a lot of text on a screen. But
especially with like the big colorful illustrations.
Yeah.
You can come up and look at them, you'll have to see them on the screen.
But more and more we're seeing smaller magazines, a magazine like a Dragon or a Dungeon are going away. Scry is still very healthy, but they're one of the only gaming magazines that's still around. We've lost Comics and Games Retailer, we've lost Inquest. We've lost bigger magazines. Disney, they had a magazine called Disney Adventures. It was a magazine for kids, sold in grocery stores. You'd see it at the checkout. They were doing over a million copies a month, and they couldn't make their advertising model work. So that was the reality that we were facing with Dragon and Dungeon. And so we wanted to try something different. We'll see, what happens. We're going to try and do, as Chris said, some really neat things with the medium, being able to look at how we can embed video clips. So it may be that if we have a gamer lifestyle article, you're actually seeing a trailer of the game we're talking about, or if there is a article about DMing or a particular adventure, maybe we have a flyover map taken from a flyover video taken from a map within the game table that shows the dungeon.
Every time you write an article, you have to come up with a video clip for
The onus is on us to try and capitalize on the medium.
Go out into the hall and tape something. We need a video clip for this article.
Well, I mean,
we want to do it right, though. We're just not going to cram stuff in there just to take advantage of the medium. I think you need to create a good user experience. You don't just want to put video in for the sake of video, because that just looks lame.
So. But certainly, one of the things we're looking at is like interactivity with the rules database, which is another online utility we're going to have that's part of Insider, right? I would love to be able to do things like have, you know, monster stat blocks hyperlinked and connected to the database, and that's something that we're looking at doing. I mean, that would be fantastic, right? You can't do that in print.
Yeah, the magazines aren't, you know, they don't sell D&D Insider on themselves. It's how those magazines and the content interacts with the rest of Insider. How does an adventure and dungeon interact within the game table? How does a new list of martial powers interact with the rules database? I think that's where we really take advantage of the medium, is making all the parts work together within D&D Insider. So you read an article about a new prestige class in Dragon, you can get that rule in the rules database, and you can create that character on the character creator and populate all that data into your character sheet. I think that's how we really take advantage of that content.
Is the coalition going to have prestige classes?
That's very third edition, Scott.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's the example I go back to.
Paragon Path.
Paragon Path, thank you.
That's
slap my hand.
Journalistic digging.
Yes.
I caught you.
Well done, Jeff.
I lost my
That's what you get for digging.
Let's switch. Let's talk a bit about the art and the visual, just the visual presentation of the books. Like, how did you like design the new logo? How did you design the covers? Is Wayne Reynolds going to do all of your art from now on?
We wish.
Do you keep him in a box under the stairs, and what do you feed him?
Wayne, you need anything? Okay, good. No, you know, it was a really long process. We started with, I was involved in that, as were a lot of people from the company, art directors, people from R&D, graphic designers. And we went through a long, drawn-out process of, we wanted to have a new logo that was distinctively fourth edition, but still was very evocative of D&D. One of the problems with the third edition logo was the back plate on it that it made it difficult, for instance, to shrink down, readjust, put onto the spine of a book. And so we had a few things that we wanted to fix with the logo. So we went through a long, drawn-out process. Do we want to sort in it? Do we not want to sort in it? Lots of those discussions, and we eventually landed on the one that we have, which I really like. It's I love the red in it. It still feels.
Does it have a sword?
It does not have a sword. No.
I like swords.
Has a cool ampersand though.
Yes.
Does it have sword chucks?
Doesn't.
It does not. But it does have a cool ampersand.
Yes.
And that's the title of Bill's.
He's always wanted to figure out how to use the ampersand, and he's.
He's finally got it. He's got his column in Dragon now. Yes, that he's called Ampersand.
He finally found a home for it.
I wanted to call it From the Director's Chair. And you can see that in our logo online because it's a little director's chair. But he decided he wanted to call it Ampersand, and he's the boss.
And we did that with
and
all...
And I think it's actually very cool, too. It's been nice. It's good, clever use of the word. So.
We went through that design process on pretty much everything for the fourth edition sort of look and feel. We already had a very solid style guide established for the classes, the armor, the weapons.
I noticed you have a much more coherent art style. Everything looks like it belongs together. Whereas third edition art was like all over the map.
Yeah, we certainly tightened that up a little bit. And with some of the new races, like the new Dragonborn and the new Tiefling, we had to sort of. Those were more created from the ground up, but other things are going to, I think, feel very familiar with some tweaks on them.
What were some of the influences on the art style?
We looked at everything. It was actually an interesting process. They had everything, and I know everybody's going to shudder when I say this, but everything from manga-style anime to heavy CG graphics to very painterly styles, almost akin to a second edition cover like
Elmore's and
Frank Frazetta. I'm thinking shuddering when I say anime and manga. That's mostly where people, I think, would kind of wig out. But.
Would you say you borrowed your visual style from a certain online, very popular role-playing game?
You mean D&D Online? Totally.
which okay, which in turn borrowed its own art style from Warhammer. So you
a lot of us play WoW, but no, wouldn't even go there.
If you look at, you can, I mean, trace it all the way back, right? Let's go back and talk about first edition D&D, right? Where, you know, let's talk about the red box.
Let's talk about it.
Right? I mean, where did that art style come from?
That was, I don't know.
And who borrowed from who? I mean, right? It's an evolving process, and the art has changed throughout the industry at large over the last 30 years dramatically.
It's gotten
right?
better.
But yeah, we're our artists on some level maybe influenced by games like World of Warcraft or games like Guild Wars, which has fantastic art. I mean, Guild Wars is beautiful. Right? Were they influenced by other games like Neverwinter Nights 2? I mean, which is a third edition D&D game. Sure, probably. Were they also influenced by Jeff Easley and Larry Elmore and other artists like that, anime artists like Scott was talking about? Absolutely. I mean, it's an amalgamation, right? It's not just any one influence. And you know, when you talk about games like World of Warcraft or any MMO, you know, you're talking about what we borrowed from. What did they borrow from? You know, I know I certainly remember a boss in a raid in World of Warcraft that reminded me a lot of a beholder. I mean,
where did that eye tyrant come from?
So we're not going to suddenly see everyone walking around with huge shoulder pads.
No. In fact, the jump in art style from second edition to third edition was much more of a departure in terms of style than third edition to fourth edition. Our third edition to fourth edition was really a refinement of that change. Things don't look as radically different as they did from second edition to third edition.
Look a lot better.
And they look, we wanted to go more consistent, right? We wanted to get a more consistent
look. Like it all takes place in the same world and
right.
There's the same mind behind this kind of...
Exactly.
Why do halflings have dreadlocks?
It's not, I don't think they have dreadlocks, right? They have braids. I think that they have small braids.
Whatever it is you want, why do they have that? I don't
you know, that's
why can't they just have like a tuft of curly hair like we all know and love?
Oh, you mean why don't they look more like hobbits?
Why
don't they have furry feet? Why aren't they fat?
Do they have furry feet in fourth edition?
No, they don't. They didn't in third edition either. I mean, we went away from fat rotund at hobbits, hobbit-like halflings that didn't look like they were adventurers in third edition. And this is really just a refinement of that look. They got a little bit taller. They have sort of a more consistent... the halfling style of their clothing and their weapons. By the way, every race has its own unique style for weapons now as well that's consistent. And halflings have a very sort of water-influenced theme to their clothing and their weapons based on the mythology that we have, that they are the nomadic people that use the waterways to travel a lot. Not exclusively river folk, but it certainly is a convenient way to travel when you don't have a car.
They're pond folk and lake folk as well.
They also travel on the ground. They have legs.
Okay, really?
Yeah, halflings still have legs. Halflings still have legs.
You heard it first here on the Tome Show.
That's right.
Is their base movement speed going to be like less because they're? Do you still have size categories?
Yes, size categories are still in the game. I haven't played a halfling in a few iterations of the rules, but I don't think they have a speed penalty anymore. So we didn't want slow halflings. They're quick and nimble, and that's what we've always portrayed them as. We thought it was weird that they were quick, nimble, and slow. Didn't really seem to fit. But as for their hairstyle, I mean, that's something that we are going to... I mean, that seems like a pretty minor detail, and it's certainly something you could change in your game.
You'd be surprised what fans out there consider a major detail.
I'm not really
sacred
surprised.
Beef.
I'm not really surprised by anything anymore.
Are you guys involved in like the actual game design? Could I ask you design questions?
Chris is.
Sure. I mean, I was on the editor before I moved to Insider, and I served on the development team for about 6 months before I started on Insider.
I'll try some like basic questions. Is there a hard cap at 30 levels, or can it go theoretically infinite like third edition could?
There is right now a cap at 30. If you wanted to take the game farther, it probably wouldn't be harder. It would probably wouldn't be very difficult to do. There are a lot of the things, like the math of the game, could continue in theory for however many levels you wanted. You would have to create your own powers and feats and whatnot that were appropriate for that level. Mostly powers. You'd want to create powers, sort of post-epic powers, so that the your damage number scaled up appropriately. But, I mean, creative DMs will probably do that, and they could.
Okay. I'm gonna bring up a bit of a touchy subject. I know that fans of epic level play in 3rd edition were very disappointed that you did not support epic level play perhaps as much as you could have. And the reasoning that you came out with was people don't want to play epic. And the response I heard from people who want to play epic is yes, we do. So how do you come to that decision that people don't want to play epic?
I think that I would qualify that statement that we made, which is in our experience, most people don't want to play epic. And part of our job is trying to give most of our fans the best play experience. We understand we can't appeal to 100% of our fan base 100% of the time. But our experience and the data that we had showed that most people stopped playing in the high single digits to low double digits, that sort of 6 to 12 or 13th level sweet spot. So we understand there was epic level play. I personally played in 2 campaigns from first level up to about 25th. We also know that, in 3rd edition, epic level play was just fundamentally difficult. It was just exponentially more difficult from say 9th level to 20th or 21st level. The number of choices that a lot of characters had to deal with. I mean, the wizard and cleric characters. I played a cleric at that level. Would take 5 to 10 minutes sometimes to resolve their turn, and it just dragged things down to a grinding halt. The game just became really clunky.
I'm gonna dig a little deeper and perhaps ask a difficult question. Why didn't you just fix that? You guys make D&D. Can't you just fix all the problems and make them go away?
Well, redesigning the entire epic level sort of second half of the game would have fundamentally changed everything down. So sort of a trickle-down effect. The math of the game starts at first level and built up, changing things at the top end.
You did a 3.5 after 3.0. Why couldn't you do an epic level 3.5?
Well, epic level 3.5 wouldn't have been... I mean, the epic level handbook was still usable in 3.5.
You redesigned the Psionics handbook for 3.5.
Well, we came out with a new book that incorporated a lot of the 3.5 changes for Psionics. The demand for an epic level handbook, I believe, and Scott might be able to speak more to this, I don't believe was very high. Certainly there was a strong vocal group, at least as I read on the message boards, but how big was that group?
I can't quantify how big the demand was. But I think the, you know, there were other things that we wanted to fix with 4th edition. The team that Chris works on and all the R&D folks, you know, they were playing with lots of different elements in their home games at work, play testing, saying, going, if I could go back, we'd change this, we'd change that. I don't think it was just a matter of fixing one element of the game, like better incorporation of epic level play into the primary rules set. I think it's a matter of, you know, really with 4th edition, it was looking at the ground up to say,
right,
how can we fix all these things that we would if we had the chance? So,
the fundamental backbone of the game from 3.0 to 3.5, the math behind the system didn't change. Fixing epic play would have really involved changing that backbone. So, in 4th edition, was built to scale well from 1st to 30th level. Epic level play in 4th edition doesn't substantially change in terms of like speed around the table, which is a big deal in epic play in 3rd edition.
So if you've got this cap at 30th level, what about entities that seem to go way beyond 30 levels, like gods or demon lords? Are you going to be able to fight a demon lord like
yes.
like
Orcus?
Orcus or Demogorgon, will you be able to fight them at 30th level?
Absolutely.
Orcus is in the monster manual.
Yeah.
He's on the cover.
Yeah.
Guess how many hit points he has.
Very many.
Lots.
One of the first Dragon articles we're going to be running is a Demonomicon article on Yinogu. And Yinogu will be statted up as a monster that
about,
you can fight.
What about Deities? Why be able to fight Hextor or Bane at 30th level?
Sure.
You might die.
You probably, it's going to be tough. But 30th level characters can take on world-threatening challenges. And I would say that if Bane decided he wanted to stomp on your D&D world, who better to fight him?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Besides, would that be fun?
Fighting Bane? Yes, it would.
Or fighting Tiamat?
Sure. I mean, that's what they're there for.
Right? Sounds like a great idea to me.
Tiamat's a big five-headed dragon. Guards the first level of guards the entrances to the second level of hell. I mean, that's a boss monster if I ever heard of one.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
That's the boss's boss.
So
Let's talk about the planes. Let's talk about demon lords and devil princes and gods. The planes went under a big change.
Right.
We no longer have the Great Wheel.
Right.
The Great Wheel had a lot of fans. What do you say to fans of the Great Wheel who are angry at you for getting rid of the Great Wheel?
I think I would say to them, check out our new cosmology and give it a try, and look for the places. I mean, the Great Wheel is certainly an approach to planar cosmology. It's
very,
also
very popular approach. I seem to recall that there was a game. A computer game called Planescape Torment sold a lot of copies based on a very popular
campaign. One of the best-selling PC RPGs of all time.
Yeah. So it's definitely not a obscure concept that's hard to understand.
Right, but there were elements of the planes in previous editions that made them very difficult to access, and they were just, the Great Wheel has a lot of oddities. You know, I'm really not the best person to answer this. James Wyatt is probably a great person to ask.
I should have asked him.
You should have asked him because he's on the story design team.
Yeah.
But I was a fan of the Great Wheel, and I was skeptical about the new cosmology until I really sat down to look at it and how it interacts with the world, the D&D world, in such a just more intuitive way. There's not these. There's so much more accessibility to the way that the cosmology is built now.
How is there more accessible? In terms of ways of getting to the planes, or how do you
getting to the planes? They're more of a sort of just a fact of life. There's going to be, like, you go to a town in D&D in 4th edition, and the people might say something like, those woods over there, you don't want to go in those, because if you wander too far, you might end up in the Feywild and have a hard time getting back, right? It's more of a fundamental fact of life.
Why can't you easily substitute Arboria from the Great Wheel? Why can't you substitute any, or Isgard?
Well, because a lot of those, as they were conceived, a lot of those planes certainly had a preponderance of high-level threats, but not a lot of low-level accessibility. And a lot of that mythology isn't something that would people have been more upset if we had kept the Great Wheel but said, but Arboria is not the Arboria you know, we just kept the name? I mean, however we changed it to make these things accomplish the goals that we wanted to accomplish of accessibility, and, people would have been upset however we went about it, but we felt that this change really makes things easier to wrap your brain around, for one thing, especially for a new player, and just more, like I said, more accessible. I mean, one of the first things that we're going to do with Dungeon is show you just how early and often you can go to the planes. One of the first adventures, low-level adventures we're going to print takes you to the Feywild.
Cool. As long as we're talking about the planes, let's talk about alignment. Are Law and Chaos still in the game?
Yes. Yes, they are.
Okay. Are they... Are they part of the alignment system? Can you be lawful good or chaotic evil? Or
yes.
Okay. Are there? Okay.
Yeah.
That's good. So there. Yeah. So I can still find a slot in the game, perhaps.
I don't know if they're in the monster manual, but I would imagine that we would probably do a slot at one point. If we don't put them in a monster manual, I'd certainly want to do them for
so
dragon.
Will there be Modrons? please let there be Modrons. I like Modrons.
No comment.
They're cute and fun.
I'm a monster. No comments.
Everybody's got their favorite monsters.
Okay, but there will be the forces of law and chaos will be evident in the game.
Yes.
How will they be evident in the game?
Well, I mean, I don't want to go into a lot of detail, and I don't know how much I can say. But
I want you to go into a lot of detail.
I will say that if you want to picture a dominant force of chaos in the sort of the multiverse, look no farther than your demons. I mean, talk about creatures that really want to rip things apart.
Demons are also evil. They're chaotic evil. What about just pure chaos?
Well, it's certainly something we can look at, but not much I can really say about.
Are there forces in the game that are neither good nor evil? There's something in between.
Absolutely.
They're still dangerous.
In fact, I would say that the vast majority of creatures that in the world are what we would call unaligned. A number of deities are unaligned in the new pantheon. So
how is unaligned different from the old neutral?
It's very similar, except it's more that you haven't chosen a side. So. For whatever reasons.
Okay.
And, there's a lot more on that in the player's handbook. The alignment system is I think, a lot more compelling now, and a lot easier for sort of wrap your brain around.
Well, there's another great interview from Jeffrey D. Wynn with Scott Rouse and Chris Youngs. Now I'm going to play you a quick promo for a show that I think you might enjoy. So listen to that, and I'll see you on the other side.
You enter a room. Immediately to your right, there is a computer, some recording equipment. In the back of the room, there is a very impressive shelf of Dungeons & Dragons 3.5 edition source books. What do you do?
I think I'd like to set up a website.
Roll for web design. You register the domain 35privatesanctuary.com. What kind of content would you like on your website?
I'd like some original content. I'd like some reviews of 3.5 edition material. I'd like a forum to talk about Dungeons & Dragons and other 3.5 related.
Don't forget that you've got the microphones on your right.
Oh, I'd like a podcast.
Roll for podcast. Critical hit. 3.5's Private Sanctuary is the online resource for Dungeons & Dragons gamers that will continue to play 3.5 edition of the rules. You can find us at www.35privatesanctuary.com.
Okay, well there you go. That's episode 49. The tome's almost 50. We're getting there. One more episode. As always, I want to encourage you to send in your emails or audio comments to thetomeshow@gmail.com and also send in your feedback. Another great place to do that is on the forum at thetomeshow.com where we've also been having rather extensive conversations about 4th edition and the kinds of things that we want to know about 4th edition or do already know. Also, you can help the show get noticed with reviews or votes on various sites. But more than that, tell anyone you know that might be interested about the show. Word of mouth goes a long way to helping the show find its audience. Also, don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store. The show gets a part of the proceeds, and that help keeps us on the air. And once again, you can find all of that at thetomeshow.com. Also, don't forget to check out our partner podcast, Fistful of Comics and Games, at fistfulofcomics.com. For all sorts of geeky goodness, and Gamers Haven at CanadianCrusaders.com for some great GMly advice. This has been episode 49. Scott Rouse and Chris Youngs at D&D Experience of
The Tome.